Blog Talk Radio.
How much fun it's gonna be together. This Christmas, fireside is blazing bright. We're caroling through the night. And this Christmas will be a very special Christmas for me. And cards are here. My world is filled with cheer and you. This Christmas, and as I look around, your eyes outshine the town they do. This Christmas, fireside is blazing bright. We're caroling through the night. How much fun it's gonna be together. This Christmas, fireside is blazing bright. We're caroling through the night. And this Christmas will be a very special Christmas for me.
What up, what up, what up? 7 o'clock on the East Coast. It is Christmas Eve. And you're listening to the very last show of 2019. This is the Matt Kinnear Experience. I'm your host. And this is going to be the last show of the year. Because next Tuesday is New Year's Eve. And people got stuff to do. So this is going to be the last show of 2019. And by the way, happy holidays, happy Merry Christmas, happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, or whatever it is you do to celebrate, happy, happy. Have a happy one. And we should say, well, I didn't say you should, but happy holidays takes everything into consideration because there are a whole lot more holidays toward the end of the year than there is Christmas. So I don't know why people are getting all bitten out of shape about that for, but every year we go through the same crap. It's phony anger for something really simple, but, you know, simple people got simple stuff to worry about. So, but anyway, this is the third program that is done every year. This is, you know, like the Thanksgiving program. This is the same thing like the Columbus Day program, because during this program and the other ones, over the years, a lot of the truth about these holidays aren't discussed. Oh, well, and Easter too. Easter's another one of those holidays that, you know, people tend not to tell the truth about. But we'll do that show when Easter time comes. But this one's about Christmas, and there are a lot of things about Christmas that a lot of people don't know about. And it's because we live in a society that thinks it's better just to, you know, not to tell the whole story about something and just ride with it versus telling the whole story about something. You know, it's a little bit easier to deceive people and then tell them the truth. And the same thing goes for Christmas. And what you're going to hear tonight, you're going to hear a long clip about the history of where these traditions came from. And then the next, there's only two clips tonight. So the first one's going to explain where all of this came from. And then the second clip is just going to be a clip of a mix of Christmas songs that I threw together, you know. And then I'll see you next year. But I think it's important to talk about Christmas because I think a lot of, you know, I think people, when you talk about religious holidays and stuff, people act like that they're off limits, that you can't talk about them. And that's wrong. Because, you know, I'd rather just sit up there and tell you the truth about this stuff than sit up there and just feed you bullshit. And there are a lot of things about this holiday that, you know, that don't match. But when you grow it up in the society, when you're kids, you can't say otherwise. You just got to go with it. You know, that's why a lot of these traditions that we have, you know, I think once people start to get older, they start to question them because it's like, you know, if you really think about them, a lot of them don't make any sense. And this is one of them, to be honest with you. I was doing research on this again and found out a couple of interesting things. And I think this is the clip that'll take. I know the other shows I did, I had more than one clip. But, you know, there's nowhere in the Bible where it says the actual date that Jesus was born. A lot of scholars think that he was born in the springtime versus the wintertime. And dug a little bit more, come to find out, and I didn't know this, that Mary was between the ages of 12 and 14 when she was pregnant. And then the age of Joseph was 90. So let me repeat that again in case you didn't hear me. Mary was between the ages of 12 and 14, and Joseph was 90. And I did not know that, because the stories that we have been told, the stories that we have been fed, would make you think that she was in her 20s. Nope. According to scholars that do this stuff as a, you know, between 12 and 14. Excuse me, I got a cold. Trying to get rid of. Because you got to remember, too, those were ancient times, and they did stuff a whole lot different than we do now. But you need to know it. A lot of people probably don't. Oh, that's interesting. So, excuse me one second. I'm having a cold. I'm trying to talk at the same time. So, like I said, this is going to be the last show of the year. But I want you to hear what I got to give you, and then you can decide whether or not, you know. But this isn't, I didn't do this to change anybody's mind. I'll just do these shows because you need to know. And they're not telling you. So I'm telling you. And it's a long clip, but it's full of information. And then, you know, and I could say happy Saturnalia, because that's where a lot of these traditions come from. And you're saying, what is Saturnalia? You will find out. Because a lot of the traditions that we do around Christmas are pagan traditions. But if you think about it, if you're on the side of being very religious, what does a tree have to do with the birth? You know, and all these other little things that we do. And I'll say this, and then I'll go ahead and play it. I've got to take care of some things while everything is playing. I've got to load up the car. Well, not car. Well, yeah, it is car. I'm going to say sled. Because if you're a father like I am, this is your year. This is your time of year to do your Santa thing. You know, my kids are grown, but I've got grandkids. So once when I thought that I was out of the game pulls me back in. So I still have to do the Santa things. But this time, instead of doing it for the kids, I do it for the grandkids. And this is their first Christmas where they're aware of what's happening. Last year they were still pretty much babies. Didn't get it, but now they get it. So I've got to do that in the morning after I get off work. So that's fun. And two, when they get old enough to understand, I'm going to tell them the same thing about telling the truth. You know, because you can play the game for as long as you have to play the game, and then it gets to the point where it's like, okay, it's time to tell. It's time to expose them to the truth. So when they get older, they'll be exposed to the truth because I'll be sure to tell them. So, with that said, I'm going to get into the show for you because I know you got things to do. Don't have to call in tonight. Just sit back and listen. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks. And we're going to go hard in 2020 because we've got a thing that's pretending to be president. And if we don't do what we got to do as a people, you think these 3 years have been rough. You don't want to go through this crap all over again 4 more years. So you need to go ahead and get your stuff together. If you ain't registered to vote, then you go ahead and get registered to vote and get ready to get this stuff and kick these people out because they do not give a damn about you or nobody else. So next year we're going hard because we got to change this. Got to change it. So just sit back, listen to the show. I think you'll get a kick out the last part of the show, but just listen for the information. And like I said, I will see you back here next year. Be good. Enjoy the show.
It is a story everyone knows. After a rude refusal by a local innkeeper, Mary and Joseph bedded down in a barn in Bethlehem. The next day, Mary gave birth to a son, the Son of God. Those are the biblical origins of Christmas. But centuries before Jesus walked the earth, early Europeans were celebrating light and birth in the darkest days of winter. In the Norse country, this winter celebration was known as Yule. Around December 21st, the winter solstice, fathers and sons would drag home the biggest log they could find and set it on fire. The Yule log warmed, but it also looked ahead. Each spark was said to represent a pig or calf to be born in the spring. Also dragged inside were evergreens, the one plant that could make it through a Norse winter. Evergreens proved that life persisted in this dark time.
There's a natural attraction to that which lives through the winter when one is struggling to survive through the winter. The evergreen is that part of nature that seems impervious to the coming of winter and the diminishing of the sun. And so it's an absolutely natural symbol, one which I think we react to almost without thinking about.
For as long as the Yule log burned, about 12 days, feasting and revelry reigned supreme. In fact, this was one of the few times that meat was abundant, since cattle had just been slaughtered for the long winter.
There is a necessity to kill most of the cattle, because you can't keep them alive long in the winter, whereas they feed them on. You keep a few alive for breeding. But there is an opportunity for a great blowout, for a great feast, time to party.
The party raged inside in defiance of winter's deadly howl.
There is a spooky feel about the northern Yuletide festivals. You may be all right there in the hall with the blazing fires, but outside there are demons, there are spirits.
In Germany, the pagan god Odin lent his name to this midwinter holiday. Early Germans were terrified of Odin, whose nocturnal flights decided who would prosper or perish in the coming year. Later, we'd see another Christmas sky rider, Santa Claus. But for now, staying inside became the smartest choice at this frightening time of the year. A 1,000 miles away in Rome, winter was less harrowing, but the December festivals were just as elaborate. One week before the winter solstice, Romans began celebrating Saturnalia, a month-long orgy of food and drink. Named for the god Saturn, which meant plenty, Rome's established order was turned on its head during this wild, delirious time.
The Saturnalia celebrations were certainly times of revelry, of turning the social order upside down, of having the master pretend to be the slave and the slave pretend to be the master. Sort of a time out of time in which one could celebrate a kind of disorder in the universe.
One of the holiday's important feasts was Juvenalia, which celebrated the children of Rome.
Although these early festivals are not necessarily about children particularly, though they are about fertility, children did have their particular place. The indulgence of children, of course, is very much a part of our modern Christmas, but it did have its place even in these ribald, drunken festivals that the Romans had.
Among the upper classes in Rome, solstice celebrations were significantly more sober. Many influential Romans worshipped Mithra, the god of the unconquerable sun. To this small but powerful sect, the birthday of Mithra was the holiest day of the year.
December 25th was the winter solstice in that part of the world, and it was also understood to be the birthday of the sun god, Mithra. And Mithra was said to be born from a rock. Shepherds came to worship him as he was an infant god born out in that pastoral place in the fields. And many of those stories, of course, have come into Christian tradition.
While Romans were worshiping the sun god, a new religion was taking hold throughout the empire. At first, Christians didn't celebrate the birth of Christ. His resurrection was the essential fact of the new religion. By the 4th century, however, the question of the holy birth became impossible to ignore.
There were questions within the church about how do we even imagine Jesus. Some people believe that Jesus was purely a spiritual emanation of God, and others believe that Jesus must have actually appeared on earth, and so the decision to celebrate Jesus' birth meant that Jesus was actually a human or a human form.
For Christians, the fact of his birth was settled, but the date remained a mystery. The Bible doesn't mention exactly when Christ was born, but certain facts suggest it probably was not in December.
If you're going to sort through the runes of the scriptures, Jesus was probably born in the spring. If the shepherds are out in the fields watching their flock by night, we're not talking about one of the cold spells at the heart of winter.
If pagan Rome was already celebrating the birth of Mithra on December 25th, it seemed natural to honor the birth of the Christ child at the same time. By the 4th century, the church made it official. December 25th was declared the feast day of the Nativity.
But it was a very short step from the feast day of the risen sun, S-U-N, to the feast day of the risen sun, S-O-N. So in a sense, it's a very good choice that the symbolism is there, because the feast day of the unconquered sun was about fertility, about birth, and so obviously is the Christian Christmas.
The church knew it could not outlaw the pagan traditions of Christmas, so it set out to adopt them. The evergreens traditionally brought inside were soon decorated with apples, symbolizing the Garden of Eden. These apples would eventually become Christmas ornaments. And holly, a traditional midwinter decoration, was recast to represent Christ's crown of thorns.
People already had their own agenda for this season, and that agenda was not one that was really radically changed when the names got changed from non-Christian to Christian names. The church pretty much had a policy of live and let live. If people would call themselves Christians and do lip service to the birth of the Savior, then let them do anything that they wanted to do with it. But on the other hand, by assigning the nativity to that time of year, the church really gave up the opportunity to control the way that celebration took place.
The tension between piety and revelry at Christmas would reach its logical and extreme conclusion in Puritan England, when the holiday would be considered so unchristian it was done away with altogether. By the Middle Ages, Christianity had largely replaced the old pagan religions of Europe. On December 25th, the faithful were called to Gothic cathedrals like Notre Dame and Salisbury Cathedral in England for Christ's Mass, soon to be called Christmas. But out in the streets, the holiday was still more raucous than religious.
If you went to England around Christmas time, any time before, say, 1800, you'd probably feel pretty ill at ease. You wouldn't think it was Christmas at all. What would you think it was? Maybe Mardi Gras? Maybe New Year's Eve? Maybe Halloween? Because Christmas in old-time England was really a carnival.
The houses of London were littered with brawling, drunken villagers and couples engaged in the most unholy activities. And each Christmas, a beggar or student was temporarily put in charge after being crowned the Lord of Misrule. The rest of the peasantry also got their once-a-year chance to grab power from the ruling classes.
They would go around to the houses of the rich, or they would bang on the doors and demand entry, and once they were let in, the lord of the manor had to give them the best stuff that he had. He had to give them his best food, he had to give them his best beer, his best of everything.
And a jolly one day, then you shall be.
But if he didn't, they would threaten or actually perform a trick.
Come, butler, come, fiddler.
One surviving Christmas song says, if you don't give us what we want, then down will come butler, bowl, and all.
If you do draw us a bowl of the small, then down shall go butler, bowl, and all. Bowl, and all.
Some historians think that it performed the role of a safety valve. You might say that a wealthy man could make up for an entire year of small or large injustices to the poor by giving a generous Christmas handout just once in the year.
The rules of Christmas would soon change, however, as a wave of religious reform swept through England in the early 17th century. Led by Oliver Cromwell, the Puritans overthrew the king's forces in 1645. And vowed to rid England of all that was decadent. High on their list was English Christmas, and in 1652 they outlawed it altogether. Shops were ordered to stay open. Churches were forced to stay closed.
The Puritans were always, I think, deeply attracted to those things that they were most opposed to. They had a fear that they might have too good of a time. I don't mean to trivialize them, but there was a deep fear that if these things were legalized, they themselves might enjoy them and their souls would be lost.
The Puritans may have said good riddance to Christmas, but the people never really stopped celebrating it. The holiday merely went underground. If Christmas pie was illegal, it began to be known as mince pie instead, which was just as delicious.
The deeper need for Christmas in the human heart, the need for celebration at a time of darkness, those needs made the battle against Christmas, gave it a few temporary wins, but it couldn't possibly secure a final victory.
In 1656, the men of Kent and Canterbury passed a resolution saying that if they could not have their Christmas day, they would have the king back on his throne. They soon got their wish. The monarchy was restored with Charles II, and Christmas was restored with him. It seemed the English could live without a king, but not without Christmas.
It has been argued that one reason for the restoration of the monarchy is because by restoring the monarchy, you also restored Christmas, restored the proper English Christmas with its rituals, its traditions, and its carousing. Christmas is brought back, if you like, by popular acclaim.
The fight against Christmas may have been lost in England, but the Puritans had high hopes for the new colonies in America. In 1620, a small group of separatists came ashore at Plymouth, Massachusetts. Even more orthodox than their English cousins, these men and women hoped to rid themselves once and for all of the Christmas scourge. In 1659, Puritans in Boston followed their English brethren in outlawing Christmas. Anyone caught exhibiting the Christmas spirit was fined 5 shillings. Like in England, however, Christmas remained impossible to contain. The 1719 Boston Almanac doesn't list a Christmas holiday, but it does recommend that in late December you not let your children and servants run too much abroad at night.
From almost the beginning in Massachusetts, there's evidence that some people practiced Christmas, and that when they did so, it was in fact an opportunity to get drunk. And one of the most interesting little sidelights on this is the finding of historical demographers that there was actually a bulge in conceptions, the conception of children, that took place during Christmas.
Not all the colonies had such trouble with Christmas. Captain John Smith, leader of the Jamestown settlement in Virginia, wrote that their first New World Christmas was kept with plenty of good oysters, wild fowl, and good bread. Jamestown settlers were also the first to drink eggnog as a Christmas drink, the nog coming from the word grog, which means any drink made with rum. After independence, however, all things English fell out of favor in America, Christmas included. In fact, on December 25, 1789, the United States Congress sat in session and continued to stay open on Christmas Day for most of the next 67 years.
At the same time, there are people who are writing in their diaries that, isn't it too bad we don't have any holidays? So after the Revolution, here is an entire nation that works hard, has forsaken many holidays, has given up many holidays because they were holidays that were mandated by the crown, and it is time to start thinking about how to populate the calendar.
As the 19th century dawned, Christmas would be one holiday that would pull the new nation together. But it wouldn't be the carnival Christmas of old England, nor would it be particularly religious. America would invent its very own Christmas, and in the process, reinvent it for the whole world. New York City, 1820. Within the space of a generation, New York had gone from a backwater port town to the center of American commerce. Great wealth came to a few during these years, and moderate livings to the burgeoning middle class. But the Industrial Revolution had also created a class of the unemployed and unconnected, whose very existence threatened the cozy world of New York's middle rung. This was never more clear than at Christmas time.
Class conflict was emerging with the earliest stages of industrial capitalism. And so what had previously just had an edge of menace, a little bit of trick, but much more goodwill, much more treat, now changed, and the menace became increasingly obvious and increasingly serious. So that by the 1820s, the Christmas season in cities like New York was really a time of gang rioting, a really very, very nasty scene. So nasty, in fact, that in the year 1828, the New York City Council for the first time instituted a professional police force for the city as a direct result of a particularly savage Christmas season riot the year before.
New York's upper class was worried. So worried that a few of them set out to change the way the holiday was celebrated. Washington Irving was America's best-selling novelist. And in 1819, he used his expertise to write Bracebridge Hall, an enormously popular series of stories about Christmas at an imaginary English manor house. Here, the classes mingled effortlessly as squires welcomed friendly and grateful peasants into their homes. And in 1843, England's most popular writer, Charles Dickens, tackled the Christmas problem with A Christmas Carol. It was a bestseller in London and America, and the lessons of the story struck a powerful chord on both sides of the Atlantic.
Christmas Carol, I think, showed the Victorians what could be the use and the meaning of Christmas in a society which was quite pleased with itself in a way, but which nevertheless had fears about inequality, about too much materialism, about perhaps just too rapid change.
There have been countless treatments of this Christmas classic, some in print and some on screen. This television version is from 1958, but the themes are straight out of the 19th century.
You want all day tomorrow, I suppose, Cressy.
Quite convenient, huh?
It's not convenient.
But it's only one day in the year, sir.
A poor excuse to pick the pocket of your employer every 25th of December.
I think the character of Ebenezer Scrooge taught a very important lesson to middle-class people.
Christmas. Nonsense. Humbug.
Because the Christmas season presented them with a real problem. What do we owe to the different people in our world? What do we owe to our families? What do we owe to our employees? What do we owe to the anonymous poor?
At first, Ebenezer Scrooge refuses to face those problems, but after his visions of Christmas past, present, and future, Scrooge learns that family and charity cannot be ignored at Christmas time.
Merry Christmas, Bob!
Mr. Scrooge!
And Mrs. Cratchit, for you!
Mr. Scrooge!
My dear, that's for you!
Really, it's a conversion story, and it's a story about this hard-hearted man being reborn to Christmas observance.
And I'm going to raise your salary and help your large family in every way possible.
That conversion story is important for Victorians to be thinking about their own conversion to the holiday, because it is very much that they are being reconverted. So many of them have given up on the holiday, so now they have to come to terms with their own reconnection with that, and Scrooge is a way of doing that.
There's this lovely story of Dickens going around America on one of his famous reading tours, and this American factory owner going to a reading of Christmas Carol, and on the way home saying to his wife, "Next year we shall close the factory on Christmas Day."
19th century Americans were discovering Christmas after a 200-year drought of Puritan disapproval. But the holiday would never have taken hold if society wasn't ready for it. One important shift was occurring right inside the family itself.
Before the 19th century, the family existed as what we might think of as an engine of discipline designed to train children to work hard. After 1820, 1830, the family was very quickly and perceptibly becoming an agency that was designed to provide the emotional nursery for children so that they could grow up being sensitive little people who took a lot of pleasure in the family and in the world itself.
Christmas was tailor-made for this transition. Now there was a holiday where attention could be lavished on children without seeming to spoil them.
The moment of Christmas where parents started to pay attention to their children, I sometimes come to think of this as the invention of quality time within the family. Parents would discover the joy that they could take out of watching the joy in their children's faces when they gave their children presents.
Americans now knew why they were celebrating Christmas, but they didn't know exactly how to go about it. The old pagan revelry was clearly inappropriate for a Victorian home, but some ancient traditions were perfect for reviving. The Christmas tree has its roots in Germany, where decorated evergreens had always been a part of the winter celebrations. But the tree might have stayed there if not for the royal marriage in 1840 of Victoria, the Queen of England, to her cousin, Prince Albert of Germany. Albert brought his German ways to Windsor Palace, including the annual Christmas tree. In 1848, the London Illustrated News published this engraving of the royal family standing by the first Christmas tree most English had ever seen. In just a few years, a decorated fir could be found in nearly every English home at Christmas.
Within a few years, if you look at Victorian diaries or letters, people are saying, we had a Christmas tree as is customary, or we had a Christmas tree as we have always had. And of course, they hadn't always had one at all. It's a custom which had started in the 1840s. And by the late 1850s, people believed that the Christmas tree was part of the English Christmas.
Americans embraced the Christmas tree just as quickly as the English had. In fact, its connection to the old world was one of its strongest selling points.
For a lot of Americans, these are going to be new holiday traditions, not something their parents observed, especially in the case of the more austere Protestants. So they're looking for a reason for what they're doing. And one of the most convenient reasons they can have is they can say, well, this is the way it's done in Germany, or this is the way it's done in England.
All of a sudden, Christmas traditions were popping up everywhere. In 1828, Joel R. Poinsett, America's minister to Mexico, brought back a green and red plant that seemed perfect for the new holiday. And in 1843, the English firm of J.C. Horsley printed the first Christmas card. A newly efficient postal service in England and America helped make Christmas cards an overnight sensation. It seemed as though every vestige of the old bacchanalian Christmas was gone, but even the Victorians couldn't clean up Christmas completely.
Victorians were particularly keen on mistletoe because, of course, you could actually kiss a lady, or a lady could kiss a man, that normally, in the normal course of events, she would not be allowed to kiss. So in a society which was fairly strict, one vestige of that licentious Christmas from earlier times is the sprig of mistletoe. No Victorian Christmas gathering was without it.
By mid-century, Christmas was everywhere in America, in the streets, in the homes, in the marketplace. The one place you could not find Christmas was in church. Most Americans were Protestant, and the Protestant church had ignored Christmas for years. But Protestant Victorians longed for official religion on this sacred day.
What a number of them do initially is say, well, if we can't find a Christmas service in our Baptist church or our Presbyterian church, let's go see what the Catholics are doing, or let's go see what the Episcopalians are doing. And increasingly that puts pressure on these latter-day Puritans to have Christmas services because there's a way in which lay people begin to expect it.
Church services, mistletoe, and Christmas trees. America's new holiday now seemed firmly in place. But Victorian America had one last contribution to the Christmas season. A jolly elf who shimmied down the chimney would soon personify Christmas for generations to come. We borrowed the Christmas tree from Germany and the Christmas card from England. But one Christmas icon was developed right here in America, Santa Claus.
Hang your stocking, say your prayers, for Santa Claus comes tonight.
Long before Santa, however, there was Saint Nicholas, a Greek Orthodox bishop who became one of the most popular saints of the Middle Ages. On December 6th, St. Nicholas Day, good children woke to gifts from the kindly saint. Bad children sulked away with nothing. In Holland, he was known as Sinterklaas. And when the Dutch came to this country, they brought tales of their gift-giving Nicholas with them. This quaint custom caught the imagination of Clement Clark Moore, a well-heeled Episcopal minister in New York City. In 1822, Moore wrote a poem for his children about a good-natured saint who came down the chimney on Christmas Eve.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there."
Moore dreamed up Dasher, Dancer, and the rest of the reindeer, along with Santa's entrance through the chimney. But at first he was embarrassed by the poem. He worried it was too frivolous for a man of the church.
Clement Moore was a minister. Here a minister, who should be on the other side, is promoting a secular Christmas with reindeer and all the rest of it. But there was no mention in the poem of anything religious. And in fact, that's why he didn't reveal who he was. In the beginning, he didn't reveal the authorship.
Moore soon owned up to the poem when it became clear that every child in America was scanning the horizon for reindeer on Christmas Eve. Less clear was what exactly this Santa Claus looked like. At first, Santa came in all shapes and sizes. A pagan sorcerer, a frightening gnome, even a drunkard on a turkey-driven sleigh. Then, in 1863, Thomas Nast, a cartoonist for Harper's Weekly, settled the matter once and for all with his version of the Christmas saint. Nast Santa was rounder and jollier than his austere Catholic cousin. He looked, in fact, like a man of his times, a man who would fit right in with the rotund, bewhiskered robber barons of the late 19th century. But Santa was a robber baron in reverse.
Instead of taking from the less fortunate, he gave to the less fortunate. He gave to people regardless of whether they'd done something or not. In other words, he gave to children. Instead of gathering together wealth, he gets rid of wealth, and he does it yearly.
A captain of industry with a heart of gold. It's no wonder that by the 1840s, Santa Claus was an irresistible image to America's retailers. Here was a guy who could sell anything at Christmas, but make it seem like you were not buying gifts at all.
Santa Claus provided a way for both children and parents to pretend that Christmas presents were not in the realm of the commercial marketplace, that Christmas presents existed in the realm of pure domestic affection. So Santa Claus played a very important role for both parents and children. He took presents out of the realm of commerce.
If the image of Santa could sell merchandise, retailers soon figured that a real-life Santa would boost sales even further. Santa has been showing up in department stores since the mid-1800s. And since then, nothing has loomed larger to a child at Christmas than this annual pilgrimage.
You want to talk to Santa Claus, where do you go? You go to the shopping mall. Now this is strange for a saint to be living pretty much full-time in a department store. It doesn't bother Americans because we are, after all, a capitalistic society. It makes perfect sense for us to have our national saint in a department store. That's commercial sense for us, dollars and cents.
Author and humorist Gene Shepherd immortalized this rite of passage in A Christmas Story, an autobiographical account of one boy's Christmas.
You know, I'd been thinking for weeks what I wanted for Christmas. I figured the best thing to do is to tell Santa Claus about that. And I looked up at that Santa Claus, and he had these big, watery blue eyes and a huge beard and all, and he's looking at me right in the eye. And he was so impressive that my mind went blank.
Ho, 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 ho. Then what's your name, little boy?
It's like if all of a sudden you're sitting on the president's lap. And he says, what would you like me to pass in legislation, sonny? I mean, your mind's going to go blank. You can't remember any of this stuff. And so at that point, Santa Claus looked at me and he says, all right, how about a football, kid?
How about a nice football?
A football. I wanted a BB gun. So he pushed me off his lap, and this elf grabbed me and threw me down a slide that went down into the snow. And I laid there for a minute, and I knew that I was not a fit person to talk to the great. Santa Claus was obviously a star.
A celebrity of this magnitude obviously needed a sidekick. In 1939, Robert May, a copywriter at the Montgomery Ward department store, dashed off a promotional children's book to lure Christmas shoppers into the store. May's story told of an ostracized reindeer with a big red nose.
Poor Rudolph. Where most reindeer's noses are brownish and tiny, Rudolph's was red, very large, and quite shiny.
This physical, shall I say, disability turns out to be an asset because it's a foggy Christmas Eve.
This fog would be hard to get through.
And this light on the nose enables poor old stumbling Santa Claus to get through.
And all the reindeer loved him, as they shouted out with glee. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history.
So you have this handicapped sort of child figure helping the benighted parental figure make Christmas possible.
Rudolph brought Christmas full circle. It was now the children who really made Christmas possible. Only they understood the meaning of this enchanted day. From Washington Irving to...
Allow me to lace these lyrical douches in your bushes, who rock grooves and make moves with all the mommies. The back of the club, sipping my wet is where you find me. The back of the club, macking holes, my crew's behind me. Mad question asking, blunt passing, music lasting. But I just can't quit, because one of these honeys Biggie got to creep with, sleep with, keep the F a secret. Why not? Why blow up my spot? Because we both got hot, now check it. I got more Mac than Craig and in the bed. Believe me, sweetie, I got enough to feed the needy. No need to be greedy, I got mad friends with Benz and see notes by the layers. True fucking players. Jump in the Rover and come over. Tell your friends, jump in the GS3. I got the chronic by the tree. Straight up, honey, really, I'm asking. Most of these niggas think they be macking, but they be acting. Who they attracting with that line? What's your name? What's your sign? Soon as he buy that wine, I just keep up from behind and ask you what your interests are. Who you be with? Things that make you smile. What numbers to dial? You gonna be here for a while? I'm gonna call my crew. You gonna call your crew. We can rendezvous at the bar around 2. Plans to leave. Throw the keys to little C's. Pull the truck up front and roll up the next blunt so we can steam on the way to the telly. Go fill my belly. A T-bone steak, cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape. Conversate for a few, cause in a few we gon' do what we came to do. Ain't that right, boo? Forget the telly, we just go to the crib and watch a movie in the jacuzzi, smoke L's while you do me. And business giving ends to my friends, and it feels stupendous. Tremendous cream, fuck a dollar and a dream. Still tote gas strapped with infrared beams. Chopping O's, smoking line optimals. Money, hoes, and clothes, all a nigga knows. a foolish pleasure, whatever. I had to find the buried treasure, so grams I had to measure. However, living better now, coochie sweater now. Drop top BMs, I'm the man, girlfriend.
Waiting to see the Christmas vacation. Santa Claus. Go straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer. Go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus. Go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a door for Johnny. Leave a door for Mary. Leave something pretty for Donnie. And don't forget about Gary. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Tell him James Brown sent you. Go straight to the ghetto. You know that I know what you will see, 'cause that was once me. Hit it, hit it. You see mothers and soul brothers. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, oh Lord, go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Fill every stocking you find. To know that they need you so. I'm begging you, Santa Claus. Go straight to the ghetto. If anyone wanna know, tell them Hank Ballard stole so. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Never thought I'd realize I'd be singing a song with water in my eyes. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Nothing for me. I've had my chance, you see. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, that soul brother needs so. Santa Claus.
Special gifts, it's time to be.
everything's come on and pay my needs. Let's turn on every love light in the place. It's time I found myself totally surrounded in your circles. Oh, my friends, we celebrate me home. Give me a number. We celebrate me home. Play me one more song that I'll always remember. I can recall whenever I find myself too all alone. I can sing. Traveling where the western winds can fly. Somebody tried to tell me, but the man forgot to tell me why. I gotta count on being gone. Come on, come on, let it be.